He picked up Caleb at school and went home to wash, and a little after 1800 they arrived at Sarah and Hollis's apartment and stepped through the door and into the party that Peter had refused. Dozens of people were there, crammed into two tiny airless rooms. Neighbors and co-workers, parents of Caleb's friends, men he had served with in the army. Even Sister Peg, who in her dour gray frock was laughing and chatting away like everybody else. At the door, Sarah hugged him and wished him happy birthday, while Hollis put a drink in his hand and clapped him on the back. Caleb and Kate were giggling so fiercely they could barely contain themselves. "Did you know about this?" Peter asked Caleb. "And what about you, Kate?" "Of course we knew," the boy exclaimed. "You should see your face, Dad." "Well, you're in big trouble," Peter said, using his cross dad voice, though he was laughing too. There was food, drink, cake, even some presents, things people could make or scrounge, some of them jokes. Socks, soap, a pocket knife, a deck of cards, a huge straw hat, which Peter put on so everybody could enjoy a laugh. From Sarah and Hollis, a pocket compass, a reminder of their journeys together, though Hollis also slipped him a small steel flask. "Dunk's latest. Something special," he said with a wink. "And don't ask me how I got it. I still have friends in low places." When the last presents had been opened, Sister Peg presented him with a large piece of paper rolled into a tube. "Happy birthday to our hero," it read, with the signatures, some legible, some not, of all the children in the orphanage. A lump rising in his throat, Peter put his arms around the old woman, surprising them both. "Thank you, everyone," he said. "Thank you, one and all." It was close to midnight when the party broke up. Caleb and Kate had fallen asleep on Sarah and Hollis's bed, the two of them piled together like a couple of puppies. Peter and Sarah sat at the table while Hollis cleaned up. "Any word from Michael?" Peter asked her. "Not a peep." "Are you worried?" She frowned sharply, then shrugged. "Michael's Michael. I don't get this thing with the boat, but he's going to do what he wants to do. I sort of thought Lore might settle him down, but I guess that's done." Peter felt a stab of guilt. 12 hours ago he'd been in bed with the woman. "How are things at the hospital?" he asked, hoping to change the subject. "It's a madhouse. They've got me delivering babies. Lots and lots of babies. Jenny's my assistant." Sarah was speaking of Gunnar Apgar's sister, whom they'd found at the homeland. Pregnant, Jenny had returned to Kerrville with the first batch of evacuees, and arrived just in time to deliver. She'd gotten married a year ago to another Iowan, though Peter didn't know if the man was actually the father. A lot of the time, these things were improvised. "She's sorry she couldn't make it," Sarah continued. "You're sort of a big deal to her."
"I am?"
"To lots of people, actually. I can't tell you how many times people have asked me if I know you."
"You're kidding."
"I'm sorry. Didn't you read that poster?"
He shrugged, embarrassed, though part of him was pleased. "I'm just a carpenter. Not too good at it either, if you want to know the truth."
Sarah laughed.
"Whatever you say." The hour was long past curfew, but Peter knew how to avoid the patrols. Caleb's eyes barely opened as he hoisted him onto his back and headed home. He had just tucked the boy into bed when he heard a knock on the door.
"Peter Jackson?"
The man in the doorway was a military officer, with the epaulets of the expeditionary on his shoulders.
"It's late. My boy's asleep. What can I do for you, Captain?"
He offered Peter a sealed piece of paper. "Have a good night, Mr. Jackson." Peter quietly closed the door, cut the wax with his new pocket knife, and opened the message.
"Mr. Jackson, might I ask you to pay me a call in my office on Wednesday at 0800? Arrangements have been made with your work supervisor to excuse your late arrival at the job site. Sincerely, Victoria Sanchez, President, Texas Republic."
"Dad?
Why was there a soldier at the door?
Caleb had wandered into the room, rubbing his eyes with his fists. Peter read the message again. What could Sanchez want with him?
It's nothing, he said.
Are you in the army again?
He looked at the boy. 10 years old. He was growing so fast.
Of course not, he said, and put the note aside. Let's get you back to bed.
3. Red Zone, 10 miles west of Kerrville, Texas, July, 101 AV. Lucius Greer, the man of faith, took his position on the platform in the hour before dawn. His weapon? A bolt-action 308, meticulously restored, with a polished wooden stock and an optical sight, its glass clouded by time, but still usable. He was down to 4 rounds. He'd have to return to Kerrville soon to trade for more. But on this morning of the 58th day, this was no concern. A single shot was all he'd need. A gentle mist had settled overnight in the glade. His trap, a bucket of crushed apples, was 100 yards upwind, nestled in the tall grass. Sitting motionless, his legs folded under him and his rifle resting on his lap, Lucius lay in wait. He had no doubt that his quarry would make an appearance. The smell of fresh apples was irresistible. To pass the time, he offered a simple prayer. My God, Lord of the universe, be my guide and solace. Give me the strength and wisdom to do your will in the days ahead, to know what is required of me, to be worthy of the charge you have placed in my care. Amen. Because something was coming. Lucius could feel it. He knew it the same as he knew his own heartbeat, the wind of breath in his chest, the carriage of his bones. The long arc of human history was headed toward the hour of its final test. When this hour would come, there was no knowing. But come it surely would, and it would be a time for warriors, for men like Lucius Greer. 3 years had passed since the liberation of the homeland. The events of that night were still with him. Indelible memories flashed upon his consciousness. The bedlam of the stadium, and the virals making their entrance, the insurgency's unleashing of their firepower upon the Red Eyes, and Alicia and Peter advancing on the stage, guns drawn, firing again and again. Amy in chains, a meager figure. And then the roar that rose from her throat as she'd released the power within herself. Her body transforming, shedding its human shape, and then the snap of the chains as she freed herself and her bold leap, quick as lightning, upon the monstrous enemies. The chaos and confusion of battle, and Amy trapped beneath Martinez, 10th of 12. The bright flash of destruction, and the absolute quiet of aftermath. The whole world arrested into stillness. By the time Lucius had returned to Kerrville the following spring, he knew he could no longer dwell among people. The meaning of that night was clear. He had been called to a solitary existence. Alone, he had constructed his modest hut along the river, only to feel the pull of something deeper, summoning him into the wilderness. Lucius, lay yourself bare. Put down your lendings. Cast aside all worldly comforts that you may know me. With nothing but a blade and the clothes on his back, he had ventured into the dry hills and beyond, no destination but the deepest solitude he could find, so that his life might find its true shape. Days without food, his feet torn and bloody, tongue thick in his mouth from thirst. As the weeks went by, with only the rattlesnakes and cacti and scorching sun for company, he had begun to hallucinate. A stand of saguaros became rows of soldiers at attention. Lakes of water appeared where there were none. A line of mountains took the form of a walled city in the distance. He experienced these apparitions uncritically, with no awareness of their falsehood. They were real, because he believed them to be so. Likewise did the past and present blend in his mind.
At times he was Lucius Greer, major of the expeditionary. At others, a prisoner of the stockade. At still others, a young recruit, or even his boyhood self. For weeks he wandered in this condition, a being of multiple worlds. Then one day he awoke to discover himself lying in a gully beneath an obliterating midday sun. His body was grotesquely emaciated, covered with scratches and sores. His fingers were bloody, some of the nails torn away. What had happened? Had he done this to himself? He possessed no recollection, only a sudden, overwhelming awareness of the image that had come to him during the night. Lucius had received a vision. He had no sense of where he was, only that he needed to walk north. 6 hours later, he found himself on the Kerrville Road. Mad with thirst and hunger, he continued to walk until just before nightfall, when he saw the sign with the red X. The hard box was amply stocked. Food, water, clothes, gas, weapons and ammo, even a generator. Most welcome of all to his eyes was the Humvee. He washed and cleaned his wounds and spent the night on a soft cot, and in the morning he fueled up the vehicle, charged the battery and filled the tires and headed east, reaching Kerrville on the morning of the second day. At the edge of the Orange Zone, he abandoned the Humvee and made his way into the city on foot. There, in a dark room in H-Town, among men he did not know and whose names were never offered, he sold 3 of the carbines from the hard box to buy a horse and other supplies. By the time he arrived at his hut, night was falling. It stood modestly among the cottonwoods and swamp oaks at the edge of the river, just one room with a packed dirt floor. Yet the sight of it filled his heart with the warmth of return. How long had he been away? It seemed like years, whole decades of life. And yet it was just a matter of months. Time had come full circle. Lucius was home. He unsaddled, tied up his horse, and entered the hut. A nest of fluff and twigs on the bed indicated where something had made its home in his absence, but the sparse interior was otherwise unaltered. He lit the lantern and sat at the table. At his feet was the duffel bag of supplies. The Remington, a box of cartridges, fresh socks, soap, a straight razor, matches, a hand mirror, a half dozen quill pens, 3 bottles of Dewberry ink, and sheets of thick, fibrous paper. At the river he filled his wash basin, then returned to the house. The image in the mirror was neither more nor less shocking than he expected. Cheeks cratered, eyes sunk way back in his skull, skin scorched and blistered, a tangle of madman's hair. The lower half of his face was buried beneath a beard that a family of mice would gladly live in. He had just turned 52. The man in the mirror was an easy 65. Well, he said to himself, if he was going to be a soldier again, even an old, broken-down one, he damn well ought to look the part. Lucius hacked away at the worst of his hair and beard, then used the straight razor and soap to shave himself clean. He tossed the soapy water out the door and returned to the table, where he'd laid out his paper and pens. Lucius closed his eyes. The mental picture that had come to him that night in the gully wasn't like the hallucinations that had dogged him during his sojourn in the desert. It was more like a memory of something lived. He brought its details into focus, his mind's eye roaming its visual expanse. How could he ever hope to capture something so magnificent with his amateur's hand? But he would have to try. Lucius began to draw. A rustling in the brush. Lucius drew the rifle scope to his eye. There were 4 of them, rooting through the dirt, snuffling and grunting. 3 sows and a boar, reddish-brown, with large razor-sharp tusks. 150 pounds of wild pig for the taking. He fired. While the sows scattered, the boar staggered forward, shuddered with a deep twitch, and went down on its front legs. Lucius held the image in his scope. Another twitch, deeper than the first, and the animal flopped on its side. Lucius scrambled down the ladder and went to where the animal lay in the grass. He rolled the boar onto the tarp, dragged it to the tree line, looped the animal's hind legs together, set the hook, and began to hoist him up. When the boar's head reached the height of Lucius's chest, he tied off the rope, positioned the basin beneath the hog, drew his knife, and slashed the animal's throat. A gush of hot blood splattered into the basin. The boar would produce as much as a gallon. When the boar had emptied out, Lucius funneled the blood into a plastic jug. With more time on his hands, he would have gutted and butchered the animal and smoked the meat for trade. But it was day 58, and Lucius needed to be on his way. He lowered the corpse to the ground, at least the coyotes would get the benefit, and returned to the hut. He had to admit it. The place looked like a madman lived there. A little over 2 years since Lucius had first put pen to paper, and now the walls were covered with the fruits of his labor. He'd branched out from ink to charcoal, graphite pencil, even paint, which cost a bundle. Some were better than others. Viewing them in chronological order, one could trace his slow, at times frustratingly inept, self-education as an artist. But the best ones satisfyingly captured the image Lucius carted around in his head all day, like the notes of a song he couldn't shake except by singing. Michael was the only person who'd seen the pictures. Lucius had kept his distance from everyone, but Michael had tracked him down through somebody on the trade, a friend of Lore's. One evening over a year ago, Lucius had returned from setting his traps to find an old pickup parked in his yard and Michael sitting on the open tailgate. Over the years Greer had known him, he had grown from a rather meek-looking boy to a well-made specimen of manhood in its prime, hard and sleek, with strong features and a certain severity around the eyes. The sort of companion you could count on in a bar fight that began with a punch to the nose and ended with running like hell. "Holy damn, Greer," he said. "You look like shit on a biscuit. What does a man have to do to get a little hospitality around this place?" Lucius got the bottle. At first it wasn't quite clear what Michael wanted. He seemed changed to Lucius, a little at loose ends, a bit sunk down into himself. One thing Michael had never been was quiet. Ideas and theories and various campaigns, however cockeyed and half-baked, shot from the man like bullets. The intensity was still there. You could practically warm your hands on the man's skull. But it had a darker quality, the feel of something caged, as if Michael were chewing on something he didn't have words for. Lucius had heard that Michael had quit the refinery, split from Lore, built some kind of boat and spent most of his time on it, sailing out alone into the Gulf. What the man was looking for in all that empty ocean, he never got around to saying, and Lucius didn't press. How would he have explained his own hermetic existence? But over the course of the evening they passed together, getting drunker and drunker on a bottle of Dunk's Special Recipe Number 3. Lucius wasn't much of a drinker these days, though the stuff came in handy as a solvent. He came to think that Michael didn't really have a reason for appearing at his doorstep, beyond the basic human urge to be around another person. Both of them were doing their time in the wilderness, after all, and maybe what Michael really wanted, when you boiled away the bullshit, was a few hours in the company of someone who understood what he was going through. This profound impulse to be alone, just when all of them should have been dancing for joy and having babies and generally celebrating a world where death didn't reach down from the trees and snatch you just for the hell of it. For a while, they caught up on news of the others. Sarah's job at the hospital, and her and Hollis's long-awaited move out of the refugee camps into permanent housing. Lore's promotion to crew chief at the refinery. Peter's resignation from the expeditionary to stay home with Caleb. Eustace's decision, which surprised no one, to resign from the expeditionary and return with Nina to Iowa. A tone of optimistic good cheer glazed the surface of the conversation. But it only went so deep. And Lucius wasn't fooled, always lurking beneath the surface were the names they weren't saying.
Lucius had told nobody about Amy. Only he knew the truth. On the matter of Alicia's fate, Lucius had nothing to offer. Nor, apparently, did anybody else. The woman had vanished into the great Iowa emptiness. At the time, Lucius had been unconcerned. Alicia was like a comet, given to long, unannounced absences and blazing, unanticipated returns. But as the days went by with no sign of her, Michael trapped in his bed with his casted leg in a sling, Lucius watched the fact of her disappearance burning in his friend's eyes like a long fuse, looking for a bomb. "You don't get it," he told Lucius, practically levitating off his bed with frustration. "This isn't like the other times." Lucius didn't bother to contradict him. The woman needed absolutely nobody, nor did he try to stop Michael when, 12 hours after the cast came off, the man saddled up and rode into a snowstorm to look for her. A highly questionable move, considering how much time had passed and the fact that he could barely walk. But Michael was Michael. You didn't tell the man no. And there was something oddly personal about the whole thing, as if Alicia's leaving was a message just for him. He returned 5 days later, half frozen, having run a 100-mile perimeter, and said no more about it, not that day or all the days after. He'd never even said her name. They had all loved her, but there existed a kind of person, Lucius knew, whose heart was unknowable, who was born to stand apart. Alicia had stepped into the ether, and with 3 years gone by, the question in Lucius's mind wasn't what had become of her, but if she'd really been there in the first place. It was well past midnight, after the last glasses had been poured and tossed back, when Michael finally raised the subject that, in hindsight, had been plaguing him all night.
"Do you really think they're gone? The Drax, I mean."
"Why would you ask that?"
Michael cocked an eyebrow.
"Well, do you?"
Lucius framed his answer carefully.
"You were there. You saw what happened. Kill the 12 and you kill the rest.
If I'm not mistaken, that was your idea. It's a little late to change your mind."
Michael glanced away and said nothing. Had the answer satisfied him?
"You should come sailing with me sometime," he said finally, brightening somewhat. "You'd really like it. It's a big, wide world out there, like nothing you've ever seen."
Lucius smiled. Whatever was eating the man, he wasn't ready to talk about it.
"I'll give it some thought.
Consider it a standing invitation."
Michael got to his feet, one hand clutching the edge of the table for balance.
"Well, I, for one, am completely hammered. If it's all right with you, I think it's time for me to go throw up and pass out in my truck."
Lucius gestured toward his narrow cot.
"The bed's yours if you want it."
"That's sweet of you. Maybe when I get to know you better."
He stumbled to the door, where he turned to cast his bleary gaze around the tiny room.
"You're quite the artist, Major. Those are interesting pictures. You'll have to tell me about them sometime."
And that was all. When Lucius awoke in the morning, Michael was gone. He thought he might see the man again, but no more visits were forthcoming. He supposed Michael had gotten what he was looking for, or else he'd decided that Lucius didn't have it.
"Do you really think they're gone?"
What would his friend have said if Lucius had actually answered his question? Lucius put these disconcerting thoughts aside. Leaving the jug of boar's blood in the shade of the hut, he walked down the hillside to the river. The water of the Guadalupe was always cold, but here it was colder. Where the river made a bend, there was a deep hole, 20 feet to the bottom, fed by a natural spring. Tall banks of white limestone encircled the edge. Lucius stripped off his boots and trousers, grabbed the rope he'd left in place, took a deep breath, and dove in a clean arc into the water. With every foot of his descent, the temperature dropped. The satchel, made of heavy canvas, was secured beneath an overhang, protected from the current. Lucius tied the rope to the satchel's handle, tugged it free of the overhang, blew the air from his lungs, and descended. He climbed out on the opposite shore, walked downstream to a shallow spot, crossed the river again, and followed a path to the top of the limestone wall. There he sat at the edge, took the rope in his hands, and hauled up the satchel. He dressed again and carried the satchel back to the hut. There, at the table, he removed the contents. 8 more jugs, for 9 gallons total. The same amount of blood, more or less, that coursed through the circulatory systems of 6 human adults. Once it was out of the river, his prize would quickly spoil. He strung the jugs together and gathered his supplies. 3 days' worth of food and water, the rifle and ammo, a blade, a lantern, a length of sturdy rope, and carried them out to the paddock. Not even 0700, but already the sun was blazing. He saddled his horse, slid the rifle into its holder, and slung the rest over the horse's withers. He never bothered with a bedroll. He'd be riding through the night, arriving in Houston on the morning of the 60th day. With a tap of his heels to the horse's flanks, he was off. 4. Gulf of Mexico, 22 nautical miles south-southeast of Galveston Island. 0430. Michael Fisher awoke to the pattering of rain on his face. He drew his back upright against the transom. No stars, but to the east, a narrow transect of ditchwater dawn light hovered between the horizon and the clouds. The air was dead calm, though this wouldn't last. Michael knew a storm when he smelled one. He unfastened his shorts, jutted his pelvis over the stern, and released a urine stream of satisfying volume and duration into the waters of the Gulf. He wasn't especially hungry, hunger being something he'd taught his body to ignore, but he took a moment to go below and mix a batch of powdered protein and drink it down in 6 throat-pumping gulps. Unless he was mistaken, and he almost never was, the morning would bring its share of excitement. Best to face it with a full belly. He was back on deck when the first jag of lightning forked the horizon. 15 seconds later, the thunder arrived in a long, rolling peal, like a grumpy god clearing its throat. The air had picked up, too, in the disorganized manner of an approaching squall. Michael unhooked the self-steerer and took the tiller in his fist as the rain arrived in earnest. A hot, needling, tropical rain that soaked him in a second. About the weather, Michael lacked any strong opinion. Like everything else, it was what it was, and if this was to be the storm that finally sent him to the bottom, well, it wasn't like he hadn't asked for it. Really? Alone? In that thing? Are you crazy? Sometimes the questions were kindly meant, an expression of genuine concern. Even total strangers tried to talk him out of it. But more often than not, the speaker was already riding him off. If the sea didn't kill him, the barrier would. That blockade of floating explosives said to encircle the continent. Who in his right mind would tempt fate like that? And especially now, when not a single viral had been seen for what, going on 36 months? Wasn't a whole continent sufficient space for a restless soul to roam around in? Fair enough. But not every choice came down to logic. A lot came from the gut. What Michael's gut was telling him was that the barrier didn't exist, that it had never existed. He was raising his middle finger to history, 100 years of humanity saying, "Not me, no way, you go on ahead without me." That, or playing Russian roulette, which, given his family history, wasn't necessarily out of the question. His parents' suicide wasn't something he liked to think about. But of course he did. In some room in his brain, a movie of that morning's events was constantly running. Their gray, empty faces, and the tautness of the ropes around their necks. The slight creaking sound they made. The elongated shapes of their bodies. The absolute, unoccupied looseness of them. the darkness of their toes, bloated with pooled blood. Michael's initial reaction had been complete incomprehension. He'd stared at the bodies for a good 30 seconds, trying to parse the data, which came to him in a series of free-floating words he couldn't stick together. Mom, Dad, hanging, rope, barn, dead. Before an explosion of white-hot terror in his 11-year-old brain sent him dashing forward to scoop their legs into his arms, to push their bodies upward, all the while screaming Sarah's name so she could come and help him. They'd been dead for many hours. His efforts were pointless. Yet one had to try. A lot of life, Michael had learned, came down to trying to fix things that weren't fixable. So, the sea, and his solo wanderings upon it. It had become a home of a kind. His boat was the Nautilus. Michael had taken the name from a book he'd read years ago, when he was just a little in the sanctuary. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, an old yellowed paperback, pages popping loose, and on its cover the image of a curious armor-plated vehicle that seemed like a cross between a boat and an undersea tank, entwined in the suctioning tentacles of a sea monster with one huge eye. Long after the details of the story had fallen away from his mind, the image had stayed with him, seared into his retinas. When it came time to christen his craft, after 2 years of planning and execution and plain old guesswork, Nautilus had seemed a natural. It was as if he'd been storing the name in his brain for later use. 36 feet from stern to bowsprit with a 6-foot draft, one main and one headsail, masthead rigged with a small cabin, though he almost always slept on the deck. He'd found it in a boatyard near San Luis Pass, tucked away in a warehouse, still standing on blocks. The hull, made of polyester resin, was sound, but the rest was a mess. Deck rotted, sails disintegrated, anything metal fatigued beyond use. It was, in other words, perfect for Michael Fisher, first engineer of light and power and oiler first class, and within a month he'd quit the refinery and cashed in 5 years of unspent paychecks to buy the tools he needed and hire a crew to bring them down to San Luis. Really? Alone? In that thing? Yes, Michael told them, unfolding his drawing on the table. Really. How ironic that after all those years of blowing on the embers of the old world, trying to relight civilization with its leftover machines. In the end, it should be the most ancient form of human propulsion that seized him. The wind blew, it back-eddied along the edge of the sail, it created a vacuum that the boat forever tried to fill. With every voyage he took, he went a little longer, a little farther, a little more crazily out there. He'd traced the coasts at the start, getting the feel of things. North and east along the coast to oil-mucked New Orleans and its depressing plume of gooey, river-borne chemical stink. South to Padre Island, with its long, wild stretches of sand as white as talc. As his confidence grew, his trajectories expanded. From time to time he came across the anachronistic leavings of mankind. Clumps of rusted wreckage piled along the shoals, ersatz atolls of bobbing plastic, derelict oil rigs bestriding massive slicks of pumped-out sludge. But soon he left all of these behind, driving his craft deeper into the heart of an oceanic wilderness. The water's color darkened. It contained incredible depths. He shot the sun with his sextant, plotting his course with a stub of pencil. One day it occurred to him that beneath him lay nearly a mile of water. The morning of the storm, Michael had been at sea for 42 days. His plan was to make Freeport by noon, restock, rest for a week or so. He really needed to put on some weight, and set out again. Of course, there would be Lore to contend with. Always an uncomfortable business. Would she even speak to him? Just glare at him from a distance? Grab him by the belt and drag him into the barracks for an hour of angry sex that, against his better judgment, he couldn't make himself refuse? Michael never knew what it would be, or which made him feel worse. He was either the asshole who had broken her heart, or the hypocrite in her bed. Because the one thing he couldn't find the words to explain was that she had nothing to do with any of it. Not the Nautilus, or his need to be alone, or the fact that, although she was in every way deserving, he could not love her in return. His thoughts went, as they often did, to the last time he'd seen Alicia. The last time anyone had, as far as he knew. Why had she chosen him? She had come to him in the hospital, on the morning before Sarah and the others had left the homeland to return to Kerrville. Michael wasn't sure what time it was. He was asleep and awoke to see her sitting by his bed. She had this look on her face. He sensed that she'd been sitting there for some time, watching him as he slept.
"Lish?"
She smiled. "Hey, Michael." That was it, for at least another 30 seconds. No, "How are you feeling?" or "You look kinda ridiculous in that cast circuit," or any of the thousand little barbs that the two of them had fired at each other since they were little kids. "Can you do something for me? A favor?"
"Okay."
But the thought went unfinished. Alicia looked away, then back again. "We've been friends a long time, haven't we?"
"Sure," he said. "Absolutely we have."
"You know, you were always so damn smart. Do you remember... Now, when was this?"
"I don't know. We were just a couple of kids.
I think Peter might have been there. Sarah, too. We all snuck up to the wall one night. And you gave this speech. An actual speech, I swear to God, about how the lights worked, the turbines and the batteries and all the rest of it. You know, up until then, I thought that they just came on by themselves.
Seriously.
God, I felt so dumb."
He shrugged, embarrassed. "I was kind of a show-off, I guess."
"Oh, don't apologize. I thought it right then. That kid's really got something. Someday, when we need him, he's going to save our sorry asses."
Michael hadn't known what to say. Never had he seen anyone who looked so lost, so weighed down by life.
"What did you want to ask me, Lish?"
"Ask you?"
"You said you needed a favor."
She frowned, as if the question didn't quite make sense to her.
"I guess I did, didn't I?"
"Lish, are you okay?"
She rose from her chair. Michael was about to say something else. He wasn't sure what. When she leaned forward, brushed his hair aside, and, amazing him utterly, kissed him on the forehead.
"Take care of yourself, Michael. Will you do that for me? They're going to need you around this place."
"Why? Are you going somewhere?
Just promise me."
And there it was, the moment when he'd failed her. 3 years later, and still he was reliving it over and over, like a hiccup in time. The moment when she told him she was leaving for good, and the one thing he could have said to keep her there.
"Somebody loves you, Lish. I love you.
Me. Michael. I love you, and I've never stopped and never ever will." But the words got tangled up somewhere between his mouth and his brain, and the moment slipped away.
"Okay?"
"Okay," she said, and then was gone. But the storm, on the morning of his 42nd day at sea, lost in these thoughts, Michael had let his attention drift, had noted but failed to fully process the sea's growing hostility, the absolute blackness of the sky, the accumulating fury of the wind. Too quickly it arrived with an ear-splitting blast of thunder and a massive, rain-saturated gust that slapped the boat like a giant hand, heeling it hard. "Whoa," thought Michael, scrambling up the transom. What the holy fuck? The moment had passed to reef the sail. The only thing to do was take the squall head on. He tightened the main sheet and steered his boat close to the wind. Water was pouring in, foaming over the bow, dumping from the heavens in sheets. The air was lit with voltage. He locked the main in his teeth, pulled it as tight as it could go, and snapped it down in the block. All right, he thought. At least you let me take a piss first. Let's see what you've got, you bastard. Into the storm, he went. 6 hours later, he emerged, his heart soaring with victory. The squall had blown through, carving a pocket of blue air behind it. He had no idea where he was. He had been thrown far off course. The only thing to do was head due west and see where he made landfall. 2 hours later, a long gray line of sand appeared. He approached it on a rising tide. Galveston Island. He could tell from the wreckage of the old seawall. The sun was high, the winds fair. Should he turn south for Freeport? Home, dinner, a real bed and all the rest? Or something else? But the events of the morning made this prospect seem depressingly tame, a too meager conclusion to the day. He decided to scout the Houston Ship Channel. He could anchor for the night there, then proceed to Freeport in the morning. He examined his chart. A narrow wedge of water separated the north end of the island from the Bolivar Peninsula. On the far side lay Galveston Bay, a roughly circular basin, 20 miles wide, leading at its northeastern edge to a deep estuary, lined with the wreckage of shipyards and chemical plants. Running before the wind, he made his way into the bay. Unlike the brown-tinged surf of the coastline, the water was clear, almost translucent, with a greenish cast. Michael could even see fish, dark shapes running below the surface. In places, the shoreline was clotted with huge masses of debris, but elsewhere, it seemed scrubbed clean. The afternoon had begun to fade as he approached the estuary's mouth. A large, dark shape stood in the channel. As he neared, the image came into focus. A massive ship, hundreds of feet long. It had come to rest midway between two stanchions of a suspension bridge that traversed the channel. He guided his craft closer. The ship was listing slightly to port, bow down, the tops of its massive propellers just visible above the waterline. Was it aground? How had it gotten there? Probably the same way he had, pulled by the tides through Bolivar Pass. Across the stern, dripping with rust, was written the vessel's name and registry. Bergensfjord, Oslo, Norway. He drew the Nautilus alongside the closest stanchion. Yes, a ladder. He tied off, dropped his sails, then went below to fetch a pry bar, a lantern, an assortment of tools, and 2 100-yard lengths of heavy rope. He put his supplies in a backpack, returned to the deck, took a steadying breath, and began to climb. Michael didn't care for heights. Not much else got to him, except for that. At the refinery, circumstances often placed him somewhere far above the ground, swinging from a harness on the towers, chipping off the rust, and over time he'd become more brave about it, insofar as his crew could tell. But exposure went only so far in its curative effects. The ladder, steel rungs set into the concrete of the stanchion, was not, on close inspection, anywhere near as sturdy as it had appeared from below. Some of the rungs seemed barely attached. By the time he reached the top, his heart felt like it was stuffed against the back of his throat. He lay on his back on the suspension bridge's roadway, just breathing, then peered over the edge. He guessed it was 150 feet down to the ship's deck. Maybe more. Jesus. He tied the rope to the railing and watched it fall. The trick would be using his feet to control his descent. Taking the rope in his hands, he leaned backward over the edge, swallowed hard, and stepped off. For half a second, he believed he had made the biggest mistake of his life,
What a stupid idea. He was going to plummet like a rock to the deck. But then his feet found the rope, wrapping it in a death grip. Hand over hand, he made his way down. Michael guessed the boat had been some kind of freight vessel. He headed for the stern, where an open metal staircase led to the pilot house. At the top of the stairs, he came to a heavy door with a handle that refused to move. He popped the handle loose with the pry bar and inserted the tip of a screwdriver into the mechanism. A bit of jiggling, tumblers clacking, and with a second pop of the pry bar, the door swung free. An eye-watering ammoniac funk filled the air, air that nobody had breathed for a century. Beneath the broad windshield, with its view of the channel, was the ship's control panel. Rows of switches and dials, flat panel displays, computer keyboards. In one of the three high-backed chairs that faced the panel was a body. Time had turned it into little more than a shrunken brown stain encased by the moldy tatters of its clothing. Military-style epaulets with three stripes decorated the shoulders of its shirt. An officer, Michael thought, perhaps the captain himself. The cause of death was apparent. A hole in his skull, no bigger than the tip of Michael's pinky, marked the spot of the bullet's entry. On the floor, beneath the man's outstretched right hand, lay a revolver. Michael found other bodies below decks. Nearly all were in their beds. He didn't linger, merely added them to the count. 42 corpses in all. Had they killed themselves? The orderliness of the bodies said so. Yet the method was not apparent. Michael had seen this sort of thing before, but never so many, all in one place. Traveling downward into the ship, he came to a room that was different from the others, with not one or two beds, but many. Narrow bunks attached too high on the bulkheads, the space bisected by a slim corridor. The crew's quarters? Many of the cots were empty. He counted only 8 bodies, including 2 that were naked, their limbs wound together in the cramped space of a lower bunk. This space was more cluttered than the others. Rotted articles of clothing and miscellaneous objects covered much of the floor. Many of the walls beside the bunks were decorated. Faded photographs, religious images, postcards. He gently freed one of the photographs and held it up to his lantern. A dark-haired woman, smiling for the camera, cradling an infant in her lap. Something caught his eye. A large sheet of paper, thin as tissue, taped to the bulkhead. At the top, in ornate lettering, were the words, International Herald Tribune. Michael loosened the tape and laid the paper across the bunk. Humanity in peril. Crisis deepens as death toll soars worldwide. Virus extends its deadly reach to all continents. Ports and borders overrun as millions flee the spread of infection. Major cities in chaos as massive blackouts darken Europe. Rome, AP, May 13th. The world stood on the edge of chaos Tuesday night as the disease known as the Easter virus continued its deadly march across the globe. Although the disease's rapid spread makes estimates of the dead difficult, UN health officials say the toll numbers in the hundreds of millions. The virus, an airborne variant of the one that decimated North America 2 years ago, emerged in the Caucasus region of Central Asia just 59 days ago. Health officials have been at pains to identify either a source of the virus or an effective treatment. What we can say at this point is that this pathogen is unusually vigorous and highly lethal, said Madeleine Duplessis, chairman of the World Health Organization's executive board, speaking from its headquarters in Geneva. Morbidity rates are running very close to 100%. Unlike the North American strain, the Easter virus does not require close physical contact to pass from person to person and can travel great distances attached to dust motes or respiratory droplets, causing many health officials to liken it to the Spanish influenza epidemic of 1918, which killed as many as 50 million people worldwide. Travel bans have done little to slow its spread,
as have attempts by officials in many cities to prevent people from congregating in public places. I fear we are on the verge of losing control of the situation, said Italian Health Minister Vincenzo Monti in an extended press briefing, during which coughing could be heard throughout the room. I cannot stress enough the importance that people stay indoors. Children, adults, the elderly, none has been spared the effects of this cruel epidemic. The only way to survive this disease is not to catch it. Absorbed through the lungs, the Easter virus acts swiftly to overwhelm the body's defenses, attacking the respiratory system and digestive tracts. Early symptoms include disorientation, fever, headache, coughing, and vomiting with little or no warning. As the pathogen takes hold, victims experience massive internal hemorrhaging, typically leading to death within 36 hours, though some cases have been reported in which healthy adults have succumbed within as little as 2 hours. In rare instances, victims of the illness have exhibited the transformative effects of the North American strain, including a marked increase in aggressiveness. But whether any of these individuals have survived past the 36-hour threshold is not known. This appears to be happening in a small percentage of cases, Duplessis told reporters. Why these individuals are different, we simply don't know at this time. WHO officials have speculated that the disease may have traveled from North America via ship or aircraft, despite the international quarantine imposed by the United Nations in June 2 years ago. Other theories of the pathogen's origins include an avian source connected to the massive die-off of several species of migrating songbirds in the southern Ural Mountains just prior to the disease's appearance. We are looking at everything, Duplessis said. We are leaving no stone unturned. A third theory is that the epidemic is the work of terrorists. Responding to continued speculation in the press, Interpol's Secretary General Javier Cabrera, the former United States Secretary of Homeland Security and a member of the U.S. government in exile in London, told reporters, "At this time, no group or individual has claimed responsibility that we are aware of, though our investigation continues." Cabrera went on to state that the International Law Enforcement Organization, with 190 member states, possesses no evidence that any terrorist group or sponsoring country has the capability to create such a virus. Despite the many challenges, we continue to coordinate our efforts with law enforcement and intelligence agencies around the world, Cabrera said. This is a global crisis warranting a global response. Should any credible evidence arise that the epidemic is man-made, rest assured that we will bring the perpetrators to justice. With most of the globe now under some form of martial law, riots have engulfed hundreds of cities, with fierce fighting reported in Rio de Janeiro, Istanbul, Athens, Copenhagen, Prague, Johannesburg, and Bangkok, among many others. Responding to the rising tide of violence, the United Nations, meeting in an emergency session at its headquarters in The Hague, urged the nations of the world to exercise restraint in the use of deadly force. Now is not the time for humankind to turn upon itself, said UN Secretary General An Yun Dai in a printed statement. Our common humanity must be a guiding light in these dark days. Power outages throughout Europe continue to hamper relief efforts and add to the chaos. As of Tuesday night, darkness extended from as far north as Denmark to southern France and northern Italy. Similar failures have been reported throughout the Indian subcontinent, Japan, and Western Australia. Landline and cellular communications networks have also been adversely affected, cutting many cities and towns off from the outside world. In Moscow, water shortages and high winds are being blamed for the unchecked fires that have left much of the city in ashes and killed thousands. The whole thing is gone, said one eyewitness. Moscow is no more. Also on the rise are reports of mass suicides and so-called death cults. Early Monday in Zurich, police officers, responding to reports of a suspicious smell, discovered a warehouse containing more than 2,500 bodies, including children and infants. According to police,
The group had used secobarbital, a powerful barbiturate, mixing it with a powdered fruit drink to make a lethal cocktail. Though the majority of victims appeared to have taken the drug voluntarily, some of the bodies had been bound at the ankles and wrists. Speaking to the press, Zurich Chief of Police Franz Schatz described the scene as one of unspeakable horror. "I cannot imagine the despair that led these people to end not only their own lives, but those of their children," Schatz said. Around the globe, huge crowds have flocked to houses of worship and important religious sites to seek spiritual comfort during the unprecedented crisis. In Mecca, Islam's holiest city, millions continue to gather despite food and water shortages that have added to the suffering. In Rome, Pope Cornelius II, whom many eyewitnesses claimed appeared ill, addressed the faithful Tuesday evening from the balcony of the papal residence, exhorting them to place your lives in the hands of an almighty and merciful God. As bells tolled throughout the city, the pontiff said, "If it is God's will that these should be the last days of humanity, let us meet our Heavenly Father with peace and acceptance in our hearts. Do not abandon yourselves to despair, for ours is a living and loving God, in whose hands of mercy his children have rested since time's beginning, and will rest until its end." As the death toll rises, health officials worry that the unburied remains of the deceased may be accelerating the spread of infection. Struggling to keep pace, officials in many European locales have employed open pit graves. Others have resorted to mass burials at sea, moving the bodies of the deceased by freight cars to coastal sites. Yet, despite the risks, many of the bereaved are taking matters into their own hands, using any available patch of ground to bury their loved ones. In a scene typical of cities around the world, Paris's famed Bois de Boulogne, one of Europe's most storied urban parks, is now the site of thousands of graves. "It is the last thing I could do for my family," said Gérard Bonnaire, 36, standing by the freshly dug grave of his wife and young son, who had succumbed within 6 hours of each other. After fruitless attempts to notify officials, Bonnaire, who identified himself as an executive with the World Bank, asked neighbors to help him move the bodies and dig a grave, which he had marked with family photographs and his son's stuffed parrot, a beloved toy. "All I can hope is to join them as soon as possible," Bonnaire said. "What is left for any of us now? What can we do but die?" It took Michael a moment to realize he had come to the end. His body felt numb, almost weightless. He raised his eyes from the paper and looked around the compartment, as if searching for someone to tell him that he was mistaken, that it was all a lie. But there was no one, only bodies, and the great, creaking weight of the Bergensfjord. "Good God," he thought, "we're alone." 5. The woman in bed 16 was making a ruckus. With each contraction, she released a volley of curses at her husband that would make an oiler blush. Worse, her cervix was barely dilated, just 2 centimeters. "Try to keep calm, Marie," Sarah told her. "Yelling and screaming won't make it any better." "God damn it," Marie screeched at her husband. "You did this to me, you son of a bitch." "Is there anything you can do?" her husband asked. Sarah wasn't sure if he meant to ease his wife's pain or to shut her up. From the cowed look on his face, she guessed that the verbal abuse was nothing new. He worked in the fields. Sarah could tell by the crescents of dirt under his fingernails. "Just tell her to breathe." "What do you call this?" The woman puffed up her cheeks and blew out 2 sarcastic breaths. "I could hit her with a hammer," Sarah thought. "That would do the trick." "For God's sake, tell that woman to zip it!" The voice came from the next bed, occupied by an old man with pneumonia. He finished his plea with a spasm of wet coughing. "Marie, I really need you to work with me here," Sarah said.
You're upsetting the other patients, and there's really nothing I can do at this point. We just have to let nature take its course. Sarah?
Jenny had come up behind her. Her brown hair was a